At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's big, it's hard to change, and it costs $1 trillion. If today's Wednesday, the topic must be healthcare. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. You can meet people talking about today's news at news.gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, the 22nd of July today. Great to have you with us. Healthcare reform is the topic of the day. And the week, the month, too, possibly, and quite possibly the year as well. For the fourth day in a row, President Obama stepped up to the microphones to make his case. Tonight, at a primetime press conference, Tamara Keith is on the health desk for us today. Hey, Tamara.
Hey, Kai.
President didn't waste any time, came right out in that opening statement and linked healthcare directly to this broader economic strategy he has.
That he did, because, the economy is at the top of everyone's minds, and he wanted to make sure that everyone saw the link right away.
Even as we rescue this economy from a full-blown crisis, we must rebuild it stronger than before. And health insurance reform is central to that effort.
Did he, Tamara, say anything about the timing of this whole thing? He's been very vocal about this August deadline, though it has slid recently the past couple of days. He started talking about by the end of the year. Any more information on that?
Well, he definitely did not say the word August, not once. he did, however, try to hold firm as one can without mentioning an actual deadline. Here's what he had to say.
If you don't set deadlines in this town, things don't happen. The default position is inertia, because doing something always creates some people who are unhappy.
And then this is where he started to open the door to delay, or at least he was addressing the concerns of Republicans and others who feel like it's moving too fast. And if it moves too fast, then you end up with a bill that isn't as good. And so this is what he then said.
If at the end of the day, I do not yet see that we have it right, then I'm not going to sign a bill that, for example, adds to our deficit. I won't sign a bill that doesn't reduce healthcare inflation so that families as well as government are saving money.
Yeah, on that point, Tamara, he said in his opening statement that there is broad agreement on what has to happen. Congress is still working through a few key issues, one of which is how to pay for this thing. Where are we on that one?
Yeah, it's just a minor little issue.
That's right.
And actually, he tried to downplay the significance of this. In his opening remarks, he talked about how two-thirds of this has been figured out. Two-thirds of the funding, he says, is going to come from other government healthcare spending. It'll just be cost shifting. And then he said, you know, the problem is that we're fighting over the last third. And there are all kinds of things that are being discussed. He didn't come down strongly in favor of any of them, though he did say that he doesn't want this thing to be paid for by middle-class Americans.
What about the political part of this question? It's economic in part, obviously, political in great part, and that is whether or not he changed anybody's mind. Congress is debating, lobbyists are lobbying, taxpayers are looking. Where is the conversation?
Well, he was trying to talk directly to Americans tonight. He said he was going to tell them what was in it for them. And he talked about a health care plan, a hypothetical health care plan, where health care costs would double over the next 10 years. People would lose their health care coverage. The federal government would be heavily burdened. The deficit would rise. And he said, you know, a lot of people would be opposed to that. And then he said, that's what's happening right now. That's the status quo. And I think he's hoping that message will get out to people sitting in their living rooms.
Tamara Keith in Washington this evening for us. Thank you, Tamara.
Thanks, Kai.
On Wall Street today, much like it is on health care reform, that is to say mixed, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. This is, as we've been telling you, earnings week for the big Wall Street banks. And while results so far have been pretty good, Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan posted $3 billion in profit apiece, there is a reason you wait to report the news until it actually happens. Morgan Stanley reported profits today, and Marketplace's Elisa Roth tells us now from New York the results weren't nearly so pretty.
Morgan Stanley lost $1.2 billion in the second quarter. There are a lot of reasons for that, including a lousy commercial real estate business and the cost of repaying its TARP money. But there's another reason it didn't report the kind of earnings we saw at Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan last week. Mark Lane follows banks at the investment firm William Blair. He says those banks took risky bets on the markets and made big money. Morgan Stanley decided to play it safe, and that didn't pay off at all.
They have pulled back their risk appetite in trading, and particularly fixed income trading. They're not generating the same type of revenue and earnings growth from trading that some of the other firms are.
He says that's partly because Morgan Stanley got scared off by some losing bets it made before the markets crashed last year, and partly because of poor management. The company recently announced a new head of the trading business. But some of Morgan Stanley's bad news is actually good news. Brad Hintz is with the investment firm Sanford Bernstein, and he says some of its bonds are worth more than they were 6 months ago.
Why does a bond go up in value? Well, a bond goes up in value if the credit of the company that issued the bond gets better.
Unfortunately for Morgan Stanley, accounting rules make it look like the company lost money on those bonds. But Morgan Stanley seems to think its biggest challenge is holding on to talent. Banks usually use about half their revenues to pay people. Today, Morgan Stanley said it spent more than 70% last quarter. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Elisa mentioned that one of the drags on profits for Morgan Stanley was the cost of repaying TARP money. And it was, but there's more to it than that. In addition to the billions in cash that Morgan and the other banks got and then had to pay back, they also had to give the government stock warrants, options, essentially, to buy company stock at a predetermined price. Those warrant prices were way lower than what most bank shares are trading at right now. And earlier today, Goldman Sachs bought its warrants back from the Treasury Department. Cost them about $1.5 billion to do that. For those of you keeping track at home, when you add up the interest on Goldman's $10 billion bailout, plus the price of paying back the warrants, taxpayers got a pretty good rate of return. Marketplace's Steve Henn explains that presents Congress with an unexpected dilemma of what to do with the money.
Okay, so not all of Treasury's TARP investments are doing as well as Goldman Sachs. But out of the banks that have paid us back, Treasury's already cleared close to $8 billion in profit.
Taxpayers are getting a great return. It's over 12%.
James Chesson is chief economist at the American Bankers Association. He admits that kind of return on investment might not hold up over the long haul, but
this is a big success for the government.
Chesson says by passing the bailout last fall, Congress stabilized the markets and made some serious money doing it. But now politicians in Washington have a new problem. How should they spend their windfall?
We are going to see more foreclosures because people have lost their jobs.
Barney Frank is the Democratic chair of the House Financial Services Committee.
I think a good use of the TARP money here, the dividends and interest and warrants, would be to lend people money until they get their jobs back. These would literally be loans, not grants.
Frank would also like to spend a few billion dollars allowing cities to buy up and rehab derelict properties and make investments in affordable rental housing. But Congressman Spencer Baucus, an Alabama Republican, is skeptical.
Those proposals have a human side. We know there are a lot of people in foreclosure. There's a lot of abandoned property. You know, if we were running a surplus, you could look at it. But Chairman Bernanke came before us yesterday and said, Our spending is unsustainable.
And Baucus says with the national debt already above $11.6 trillion, any profits from the banking bailout have really already been spent. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Here's something you're probably aware of, but you just figure is the cost of having a credit card. When you sign up for an account, you usually have to sign away your right to sue if there's a dispute. Instead, you agree to arbitration. The credit card companies demand it, so consumers always knuckle under. Now, though, two of the biggest firms in the arbitration business are getting out of it. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports from New York.
If you believe that going before a judge will give you a better chance of winning your case than being judged by an arbitration firm hired by the company you're fighting, then you'll agree with Taylor Lincoln of Public Citizen.
It's kind of a good day. It's not just kind of. It is a very good day for consumers.
Lincoln worked on a study about credit card arbitrators and found that in 94% of the cases, the credit card companies won in arbitration.
It's the sort of thing that any fifth grader could look at it and see that all the incentives are lined up on one side and that the arbitrator and the arbitration company have no real common sense reason that they would be completely impartial.
The two arbitration firms getting out of the business are doing so because they were sued by the Minnesota Attorney General for hiding their financial ties to the credit card companies. You'd think that's good news for consumers, but it goes deeper than that, according to David Robertson of the trade journal The Nilson Report.
Over time, it could be that credit card companies are fighting, you know, thousands and thousands of lawsuits. It would be like having little spot fires in the forest that you're trying to fight.
And the cost of that firefighting, he says, will inevitably fall on consumers.
There is going to be a rise in the cost of credit. Litigation is going to be extremely expensive.
And arbitration firms that testified today on Capitol Hill say moving the disputes into the courtroom probably won't change the outcomes. The majority of consumers, they say, don't even participate in their own cases. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Even though a healthcare overhaul has sucked most of the oxygen out of Washington, D.C. the past 10 days or so, a lot of people still don't really understand what the heck is going on. Beyond the fact that changing an industry that makes up almost 20% of the entire economy deserves attention for that reason alone, healthcare is not one of those things that most people have to deal with day in and day out. So how to make people understand what the problem is and then care about a fix? David Leonhardt is a columnist for the New York Times. He writes about the economy a lot, healthcare today. David, good to talk to you again.
It's nice to be back on.
You start your piece this morning with what might be the question about this whole debate, why nobody can figure out what's in it for me. How come that's so hard?
Well, in part, it's because this is a really complex piece of legislation, and this is an incredibly complex subject. And so I think if you ask people, and pollsters have done this, if you ask people, are they in favor of covering the uninsured, they say yes, by wide margins. But they look at it, and they look at the staggering sums that gets tossed around, and they say to themselves, wait a second, why are we doing this?
Before we get to the legislation, let me ask you about the healthcare system itself. Why is it so resistant institutionally to any kind of change?
There's a really funny thing with the healthcare system. We see the benefits, but we don't see the costs. So healthcare is paid for by us, but it's paid for in ways that we don't see. It comes out of our paycheck and Medicare taxes. It comes out of our paycheck and insurance premiums, and that pays for the medical system. Then we go to the doctor and we get some treatment, or we go to the hospital and we have a procedure. We do see that. And so the services are very tangible. The costs are quite hidden. And as a result, what we want is more and more and more and more. But that is weighing on our wages. It's weighing on our federal budget. It's unsustainable. And yet when you ask people, how do they want to see healthcare changed, they don't often say, we need to make it more efficient.
There is a political question, many obviously political questions to be asked here, one of which is why nobody in this entire debate seems to be advocating for the people who are paying for it. That is largely households and patients and taxpayers.
I think the White House would argue that it is trying to take up that mantle. I don't think it's doing it enough. But the answer to your question is that there are very powerful lobbyists and very big industries for whom your waste is their income. And as a result, what you have is every time you propose something that's going to take some waste out of the system, you have a huge outcry, whether it's from the doctors or the hospitals or the drug makers. And what they do very cleverly is they don't say, hey, don't take our income away. What they say is this will harm people. And as a result, politically, Congress has not really been willing to stomach saying no to a lot of these parts of the industry.
With all the groups who have so much vested in this, from pharmaceuticals to hospitals to doctors to patients, how does the president cut through? How does he get a message out there that's going to stick?
He starts with the advantage that he's the president, and it comes that presidency comes with a megaphone unlike any other. But I think that he really needs to persuade people that the system now isn't working that well. First of all, it's so expensive that it really is robbing us of money we should otherwise have to pay for things. And when I say we, I don't mean the government. I mean actual families. It is a drag on our income. And the second thing is that, you know, the system really isn't working as well as it should in terms of making us healthier. And there are all these doctors out there who would love to spend time with patients and help counsel them and think about ways to be healthier. But the incentives aren't for that. They're for more procedures and more tests. And so what I think the White House needs to do, for that matter, the Democrats or the Republicans in Congress could do this, is they need to persuade people that the system isn't working now because it's too expensive and it isn't delivering good enough results, and that we need a form of change that will deliver those two things. And that is broader than just covering the uninsured, but it really is the number one issue here.
David Leonhardt writes the Economic Scene column for the New York Times. David, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, global warming as a business opportunity.
I believe carbon accounting will drive multi-billion dollar opportunities for all companies in this space.
But first, let's do the numbers. Bit of a wash today. The Dow Industrials fell 34 points, a third of 1%, finished at 88.81. The Nasdaq climbed 10 points, 0.5%, closed at 1926. The S&P 500 was basically flat, fell less than a point, ended the day at 954. Apple gobbled up a 3.5% gain today. Sales were strong last quarter because of price cuts to its computers and iPhones. Pfizer rose 1%. The world's largest drug maker said profits fell, but less than expected. Boeing beat analysts' projections on profits, but the aircraft manufacturer still dipped by 2.33%. Today, AirTran also reported good earnings, and the low-cost carrier soared more than 10%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.54%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The National Association of Realtors releases existing home sales figures for June. President Obama holds a town hall meeting on health reform in Cleveland. And on Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee talks about workplace policies that help employees balance work and family during the recession. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Immigration from Mexico has slowed dramatically over the past couple of years. That's according to a new report out today from the Pew Hispanic Center. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports the economy on both sides of the border is a major factor in the human ebb and flow.
The Pew report tracks two key measures: how many Mexicans are coming here, whether legally or illegally, and how many are going back home. The first result isn't a surprise. Immigration to the U.S. has fallen to about 600,000, just over half what it was in 2006.
The flows from Mexico to the United States are quite responsive to economic conditions in the United States.
Pew researcher Jeff Pacelle says that flow becomes a trickle in every recession. The decline's more pronounced this time around because so many construction and manufacturing jobs have disappeared. Pacelle says the news gets back to Mexico and fewer economic migrants risk the trip.
We haven't seen flows this low in probably 20 years or more.
But Pacelle says even though there are fewer jobs here, he's not seeing an increase in people returning to Mexico. Paul Harrington of Northeastern University's Center for Labor Market Studies thinks he knows why.
A very wise immigration lawyer once said to me, a new immigrant's worst day in the United States is better than his best day at home.
Harrington points out it's expensive to go back and forth across the border, and there's not much to go back to anyway.
I think Mexico's really been roughed up both economically and actually politically. So as a result, I think the relative conditions are still relatively better here, even though things have really gotten much tougher.
Harrington says jobless Mexicans who stay here are probably just scraping by, waiting for the economic recovery. He says they're ready to take whatever low-wage, unskilled work they can find, so they're not making room at the bottom end of the labor market for unemployed Americans. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The budget for the Small Business Administration this year was $730 million. Not a whole lot of money compared to the federal bailout some really big businesses have gotten. But things may be looking up. The Washington Post reported today that the Treasury Department wants to use $15 billion in TARP money to boost credit markets, in part by buying up SBA loans, also by increasing the amount businesses can borrow from the SBA. Commentator David Frum says that is a very bad idea.
TARP money for small business? No, no, no. The one good thing about TARP, it's a program everybody hates. Taxpayers hate it because they hate bailouts. The bailed out financial institutions hate it because it sets limits on executive pay. The administration hates it because it cannot predict the program's liabilities. Congress hates it because, well, because everybody else hates it. Merely being hated, however, does not necessarily doom a government program. Everybody hates the Mohair subsidy, but it has outlasted every attempt to kill it. Still, a reviled and abused program is a lot less likely to endure than a program that has gained a substantial constituency for itself. So if we want to see the end of TARP, we must resist to the utmost any effort to entrench and institutionalize it. But entrenching and institutionalizing is just what will follow if the Obama administration makes good on internal proposals to extend TARP funds to small enterprises through the Small Business Administration. The SBA lending program has survived 25 years of attacks by good government reformer types. Any program that lends money to businesses that cannot qualify for commercial loans is just asking for trouble, and the SBA has a long history of getting what it asked for. The latest scandal was exposed only last year. $76 million in fraudulent loans over the previous half decade. But scandals do not dent SBA support on Capitol Hill. 99% of small businesses never get a dime from SBA, but the lucky 1% who do get SBA's cheap loans love the program and will fight to the death to defend it. Let the SBA supporters sink their pincers into TARP's vast funds, and you will never extricate them, and never see the end of the TARP program. You want to help small business? Don't mete out subsidies to a politically wired few. Instead, postpone the tax increases now scheduled to bite in 2010 for a year or two. Or better, forever.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. When or maybe if Congress takes care of health care reform, it'll turn to another amazingly complicated piece of legislation, trying to reshape the U.S. economy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Whether Congress can pass a climate change bill is no sure thing, but a lot of big companies are betting it will. They've already started tracking their carbon footprints. And as Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, that has opened up a whole new line of work.
meet Larry Goldenhirsch. He's a carbon accountant of sorts. Goldenhirsch is CEO of a Southern California-based company called Enviance. Enviance sells special software that helps companies track and monitor all the carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases they emit. And business is booming.
Enviance has increased its revenue 50% year on year over the past 5 years. I believe carbon accounting will drive multi-billion dollar opportunities for all companies in this space.
Enviance's clients include industrial giants like Chevron, DuPont, and the biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States, American Electric Power, or AEP. AEP has been voluntarily tracking and reporting its CO2 output for 5 years. The utility is now going to track the emissions from its delivery trucks and the barges that deliver coal to its 20 coal-fired power plants. Here's AEP's John McManus.
It's certainly our expectation that at some point there will be a legislative program or a regulatory program governing greenhouse gas emissions. And the earlier you get started on a program like this, I think the better off you are.
AEP and other U.S. companies are gearing up for a carbon-constrained economy. That is, one where the government limits yearly carbon emissions and requires big emitters to accurately report them. Consultant Paul Beyer at Groom Energy Solutions says the green bean counting industry is rapidly developing.
Just as in financial accounting today, we have auditors and sophisticated accounting software packages to understand and track sales and costs so we know what our profits are. We see the similar thing happening over the next 4 or 5 years with carbon accounting.
Venture capitalists have been pouring money into carbon accounting startups over the past few years, but big software and consulting firms smell potential profits as well. Some have begun gobbling up the startups in this field. Others, like Microsoft, are coming out with their own carbon accounting products. These corporate giants know it's not just oil companies and utilities that will buy this kind of software. Consumer companies like Coca-Cola are doing it already.
The fastest growing area in this market are companies which will face no regulation. Companies like a Starbucks or a Whole Food, they need, for competitive reasons, to protect their brand, to attract the best and brightest, do need to be increasingly more environmentally responsible.
Activist investors and young, green-minded employees are pushing these consumer giants. They're also getting a shove from Walmart. The retailer recently announced it eventually wants an eco-label on all the products it sells. So Walmart's 60,000-some suppliers will need to start monitoring things like their water use and CO2 emissions. And that means they'll need a carbon accountant. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, the House is really, really serious about controlling the federal budget deficit. Lawmakers passed what's called pay-as-you-go spending rules this afternoon, PAYGO in the vernacular. In essence, any new spending plan or tax cuts have to be offset by corresponding tax increases or spending cuts someplace else in the budget. The bill still does have to pass the Senate, though. And also, somebody probably ought to check for a loophole for that whole health care thing we're going through right now, no? Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 34 points, a third of 1%. The Nasdaq rose 10 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 fell by less than a point. We'll call that basically flat. Mahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, older can mean bolder when it comes to startups.
Under the radar is the invisible trends of entrepreneurial activity. We've got this aging population. We have lots of entrepreneurs who fall into those older age groups.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.